I'd like to introduce myself to those of you who don't know me. My name is Esther Min, and I'm going to be leading this series this week on women in the Old Testament. The long title I had for it was Power of the Powerless, Women Who Shape Biblical History. And I thought it would be interesting for us to look at five different women. We don't often spend very much time looking at the stories of the women in the Old Testament, although there are many. And I think it's very interesting when you look at the history that's depicted in the Old Testament, that women had such an important role to play in that history that we don't often appreciate. Another reason that I thought these would be interesting stories is because although women are present at various points in Israelite history and have a role in shaping that history, you usually don't have the kind of divine theophany associated with women's work in history and in creating history. You know, if you remember in Genesis 12, God says to Abraham, "Go from this land to a land that I will show you." So, a direct command. In the case of the women that we're going to study, there is no divine voice telling them what to do, and then they are obedient. Rather, they act within the ambiguous realm of history, and they take on often the structures of society, and they work around them. Sometimes they appear kind of devious, or at least they get things done in unconventional manners and in unconventional ways. And so I thought it'd be interesting to look at these stories because I think for a lot of us, the appearance of, you know, God or hearing a voice of God telling us what to do is a little bit foreign. But these women act without that kind of direct instructions, that direct guidance, but are working more within the sort of difficult and complex lives that they lead. So the first one we're going to do is Rebecca, and we're going to study a little bit about Rebecca, her personality, and her role in directing the divine blessing. The Old Testament is shaped as a story of a people, and according to the Old Testament, it's a people with a blessing that's passed through a certain line. Interesting concept in itself. But I thought that we would choose to concentrate on three different stories in the life of Rebecca. And the first is in chapter 24 of Genesis. Now, just as a little background, if you remember, Abraham and his family have come up here from Ur. This is the Gulf. So this is some place here. This is on the border of Iraq and Iran today, a disputed area. They've come up from Ur, and they've settled up here at Haran. So Abraham's family was up here. And then Abraham got the message from God, go down to a land that I'll show you. So he came down to this region, settled around Hebron. And we all know the story about how he received God's promise, covenant with God, God's promise for offspring and for a land, for the land, and for a blessing, for prosperity, for a good way of life, for a life that is abundant. We know that there was the problem of infertility. Abraham and Sarah didn't have any children. And finally, Isaac was born. After Isaac's born, then Abraham is commanded again to sacrifice Isaac. So it looks like that promise for descendants is put into jeopardy. But at the critical moment, God steps in again, and it's just a test. Now, what we have here is, in 23, right before the chapter we're looking at, Sarah has died. Sarah's gotten old. She's buried then. And also Abraham is getting really old. And their son Isaac is not married. So here's another problem to this continuation of the promise. So let's read a bit here. Let's read 24, 1 through 9. If someone would read, and if you would please specify what translation of the Bible you're reading from, so the rest of us, when we're reading, can compare, and maybe you'll find a translation that you like better than your own. Anybody? 24, 1 through 9.
This is the New Revised Standard Version.
Thank you.
Now Abraham was old and well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his house, who had charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live, but will go to my country and to my kindred and get a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said to him, "Perhaps a woman may not be willing to follow me back to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came?" And Abraham said to him, "See to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and swore to me, 'To your offspring I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you. You shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there." So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter.
Okay, thanks. Now it's interesting here. Abraham's old, Isaac's not married, and yet Isaac doesn't take any initiative in the action. It's his father here who's setting up a match for him. In fact, Isaac in Genesis is a rather weakly developed character. He's born as the child that's promised, but then, you know, he's almost sacrificed. And after that chapter 22, his name isn't mentioned again until this chapter. And he's certainly not seen as somebody who's very active. Maybe his parents were old and doting on him and so forth, and he was very content to just remain single. But anyway, the problem becomes urgent here because Abraham's going to die. And Abraham doesn't want one of the Canaanite women to be a wife of the son. Now, this is interesting because the prohibition against foreign wives in a lot of these stories of the patriarchs, it indicates that the women, although they didn't have political power or economic power, they were seen as powerful in the sense that if a guy marries a foreigner, he's bound to be swayed over to her religion. And we'll see in this story and in other stories that the women had a lot of power within the household to shape the course of events.
She apparently could say no, too. She wouldn't go back with him.
Good point. Uh-huh, good point. She couldn't be forced to leave her family. She had some say-so here. And in fact, if she doesn't consent, well, then it's all off. Then the servant isn't obligated anymore. Good point. Now, yeah, this oath, this putting the hand under the thigh, rather a strange form of an oath. There's one other case of that, too, that's further on in Genesis. I think it's in Genesis 49 when Jacob makes his son Joseph swear by putting his hand under his thigh that he won't bury him in Egypt, but that he'll take him out of the land. And rather odd form of oath here. Seems to be swearing on the male member here. And if an oath is a binding form of a promise, it seems to be a particularly male form of bonding. I guess it's early male bonding. Anyway, these two instances are the only instances we have of this type of oath, and we don't have any parallels to it, so it's a curiosity of this age here, but a very serious promise in any event. So now what we're going to look at next is what the servant does. He has an assignment to find a relative who's willing to come back all the way. And when we read this section, we're going to be looking at a scene at a well. And in the literature in Genesis and in other books of the Hebrew Bible, there's a kind of type scene. You always meet your wife at a well in these stories. And one reason may be that the well was a meeting place in the city. That's where the women would come out. You know, everyone would gather at the well at the source of water. So there's a basis in the physical reality of the town and the custom of the women gathering the water. The women would be out and about there. But also, it comes to be a literary convention to have the males meet their wives at the well. And for example, Moses also meets his wife at a well, and Jacob too. But right now, we're going to just read this section and see how this conventional scene is worked out here. It'll tell you something about the character of Rebecca. A good story. Look then and read. Someone please read from verse 10 on to 27.
10 to 27. I have RSV.
Thank you.
Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening, time when women came to draw water. And he said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, grant me success today, I pray thee, and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the maiden to whom I shall say, pray, let down your jar that I may drink, and who shall say, drink, and I will water your camels. Let her be the one whom has been appointed for thy servant Isaac. By this I shall know that thou has shown steadfast love to my master. Before he had done speaking, behold, Rebecca, who was born to Bethuel, son of
Milcah,
and wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her water jar upon her shoulder. The maiden was very fair to look upon, a virgin whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, pray, give me a little water to drink from your jar. She said, drink, my lord, and she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw for your camels also until they have done drinking. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw. And she drew for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not. When the camels had done drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to lodge in? She said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of She bore to Nahor. She added, we have both straw and provider enough and room to lodge in. The man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness to my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman.
Okay, thanks. So, nice to see you. Yes.
I have the New King James, mm-hmm. and in verse 22, mm-hmm. it says, so it was when the camels had finished drinking that the man took a golden nose ring, mm-hmm. weighing half a shekel. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. And later when the word for ring here in Hebrew is not specific, it could be either a finger or a gold ring, but if you look further on, the servant, when he goes to Rebecca's family's house, he recounts the whole scene. Mm-hmm. And he says here, he says, let's see, where is it? Okay, yeah, it's in verse 47. The servant says, that Rebecca reported her genealogy. And then he says, and I put the ring on her nose and the band on her arms. So, yeah, nose ring. Okay, so in this scene here, we have this poor guy, this servant going up here somewhere to the city of Nahor. And how do you locate a relative? So he sort of makes a deal with God here. Maybe he's too tired to water his cattle, or his camels too. It seems like he's getting a good deal here. But anyway, so she comes down and she's beautiful and a virgin. And notice how there's a little suspense here in 17. The servant's running up towards her and asking for a little sip of water. And first of all, instead of just saying, yeah, let me water your cattle, your camels too, she first gives him to drink. And finally, after she's done, she says, I'll also draw for your camels until they finish drinking. So she went and did that. Now, that's a lot of work, actually, because often these wells aren't just holes in the ground, but they're actually steps down to a lower level, a spring. So, and camels drink about 5 gallons each, minimum. So she did a lot of caring. You know, a gallon weighs something like 8 pounds, something like that.
And he's just sitting there. I mean, this is a servant.
I mean, he's just sitting there.
Lord and any servant, looks like. I mean,
but, mm-hmm. But isn't part of this the feeling that the well doesn't have any facilities for taking things out of it? You bring it to the well so that it's not just simply available water. You have to go down and get it, and you have to have the equipment, and you have to have permission. Mm-hmm. You can't just take water from any well without that. So he can't go in and take water from a well by himself.
Well, that's a possibility.
Well, that would be stealing, in effect, the mm-hmm. water that belongs to the village.
Yeah, there are a lot of water rights. Mm-hmm, that's true. Mm-hmm. Water right controversies within the Old Testament. So very good point. But I want to read you something that I find humorous here. There was a woman, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who read this chapter, and she wrote a commentary on the Bible in the late 1800s. And she was also struck by the fact that the men were looking on. And she said, why did not Laban and Bethuel draw the water for the household? It was certainly a good test of her patience and humility to draw water for an hour, with a dozen men looking on at their ease and none offering their help. It says, the Rebeccas of 1895 would have promptly summoned the spectators to share their labors, even at the risk of matrimonial alliance. So she is doing a lot of work. So we see her as a very kind person, a generous person, a very energetic person. We also know she's beautiful. We know that she's unmarried. She's a virgin. She's of the right age. She's of the right household, we learn. And how this goes is, just so you can visualize it, Terah is the father of Abraham, and he has a brother, Nahor. So they're two brothers. And now Abraham and Sarah are married, and they have a son, Isaac. Okay, so remaining here up in the northern regions, we have Nahor, and he's married to this woman named Milcah. Her name means princess. And so they have a son named Bethuel, and Bethuel has at least two offspring. One is Rebekah, and that's our person of interest today, and the other is her brother Laban, who becomes of interest in later stories when Jacob goes up and lives with her, with his mother's brother, or his uncle. So this is the relationship. It's let's see, these two are cousins, so tell me, you who know about genealogies, is this a second cousin or is this a first cousin once removed? What
first
is it?
First cousin once removed.
First cousin once removed. Okay, so we have first cousin once removed. And actually this, having some kind of relationship seemed to be a preferred arrangement, the cousin relationship, especially a preferred arrangement for marriage, kept the wealth of the family pretty much within, you know, the same group. And in this case, Abraham has stated that his fear is he doesn't want intermarriage. He doesn't want his son to just kind of blend into the landscape here. So going back home to get the wife. Another thing we notice is she's very very generous in offering a place to stay. And this often happens at the well, too, in the other stories, that the person traveling is asked to stay with with the family. But here, she doesn't go and ask or anything. She just says, yeah, come on, we have a lot. We have a lot of food. We have food for the camels and so forth. She's a very generous, very decisive woman.
Mm-hmm. Where does she get that authority? I mean, can anyone in the family do that?
I guess in her family they can. I don't know.
It struck me that maybe she sees a rather wealthy group of camels and people coming in. She might have had an idea that, and she is a marriageable young woman, and it's a convention to meet at the well. Maybe it's worth it to draw a little water.
That would fit in with her personality.
Yeah. She turns out to be a pretty sneaky person.
Well, not sneaky, but
she does later on.
Oh, that's right.
She lets Jacob and Esau.
Mm-hmm. She gets what she wants, pretty much.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting to tell her background, who her mother and father was. So the ordinary person would just say, I'm Rebecca, I'm not going to all this family history.
Yeah, she definitely tells him her whole genealogy here, which is handy for him. But he's hit it right on the spot here. I think that people's relations to different clans or families was really important in that time too. Probably more important even than our relationship to our family, because the clans and so forth would hang together. They were large groups of people, and there was no overarching government or military support. It was just the families for themselves. And so, if you were from a particular family or whatever, that implied, how many men you had to fight on your side, what kind of your whole status, actually. So she was telling, in a way, she was kind of telling him what state she was from, in a way, kind of comparable to where do you live, what country are you from, that kind of thing. And it was the unit, the family unit, extended family unit, was an important one for defining who you were in this time. Any other comments, questions? I think it would be interesting for people. Let's read one other of these type scenes, just to give you an idea how important Rebecca is in this one. Let's look. This is the shortest one here. It's of how Moses meets up with his wife. This is after he's killed the Egyptian, and he's run away to Midian. Look here at Exodus 2:15-22. Somebody would read that. 2:15-22.
This is from the RSV.
Thanks.
When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well.
Uh-huh.
Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water the father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up to help them and watered their flock. When they came to their father, Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She bore a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land."
Okay. Well, what differences do you see that kind of highlight the distinctiveness of our story of Rebecca's meeting at the well?
She didn't work with Moses.
Right. So Rebecca does all the drawing. And here, Moses is the one, there's these shepherds, and Moses rises to the defense of the women and waters their flocks. So Moses is kind of portrayed in this one as the liberator. It kind of is a foreshadowing of his role later on, where he delivers the people from the land of Egypt, and he does the water, he does the work too. So he's really the dominant character in this passage, whereas if we remember, Rebecca, she's the one who does all the work, and she even offers to do more than she's asked to do. So the focus is definitely on Rebecca and that other one, whereas the focus remains here on Moses. And then, the daughters here, they don't ask Moses back to their house, whereas Rebecca immediately does. And then, if you notice also, he simply gives, the father simply gives one of his daughters to Moses as a wife. When we look in the next section, we'll see that Rebecca had a little more to say in it than what appears. So You'll see a lot of the common elements. And if you also look, I think it's in, Genesis 29, you'll find another one, a similar one like that. We're not going to look at it just because of time constraints, but I just wanted to read this to show you concretely that this is kind of a formula or a pattern, and the features that are developed in each telling of the story makes it kind of distinctive, gives it a distinctive meaning and highlights different things. And in this one in Genesis 24, Rebecca is definitely the dominant personality. So, for sake of time, we're going to just summarize the next part of the chapter. Rebecca runs and she tells her mother's household, interesting, she says, Laban goes out, her brother goes out and takes care of all of Isaac's needs and takes care of the cattle and so forth. And then the family tries to feed the servant's camels. But he says, no, I can't eat because I have such urgent business. And so he tells the whole story. He tells how he's been commissioned by Abraham to find a son for Isaac. And, he tells how rich, this is probably important too, how rich Abraham's family is, how he has sheep and cattle and silver and gold and male and female slaves and camels and asses and so forth. And then he describes that Abraham's son Isaac isn't married yet, and that he's been sent to get a wife, and he describes his whole bargain with God, you know, show me the one who's going to be the wife if she offers to water the camels. And so he says, you know, this happened, your daughter or your sister Rebecca, she offered to water my camels, and so I put a ring on her nose and so forth. And so tell me now, people, and he's talking to the males of the family, can I take her back? And they say, in 50, they say, then Laban and Bethuel, the brother and the father, say, this matter was decreed by the Lord. We cannot speak to you bad or good. Here's Rebecca before you. Take her and go. Let her be a wife to your master's son, as the Lord has spoken. So good deal. Good deal. And so Abraham's servant's very happy. And he's ready to go the next morning. He's done his business. He wants to get back home. But her brother and her mother want her to stay around for a little bit longer. But he wants to, he's very, he feels some urgency here. So if somebody would read 56 down to 61 here, which tells how Rebecca came to go with him and how she was sent off. 56 to 61.
But he said to them, do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Let me go that I may go to my master. And they said, we will call the maiden and ask her. And they called Rebecca and said to her, will you go with this man? She said, I will go. So they sent away Rebecca, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebecca and said to her, our sister, be the mother of thousands of ten thousands, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them. Then Rebecca and her maids arose and rode upon the camel and followed the man. Thus the servant took Rebecca and went his way.
Okay, thank you. So they ask her. She says, I will. No pause or anything. She says, I will. And then they bless her. They send her off. And they bless her and say, may you grow, may you be the mother of thousands of ten thousands. And she then goes from up north here down to this region, and her willingness to go without hesitation brings to mind Abraham's willingness to go from this region down here. And also the blessing also brings to mind the blessing, the promise to Abraham of offspring too. So she's has a few parallels here to that important figure. Very decisive woman. And the next section is one of the few love stories in the Hebrew Bible. It's the meeting of Isaac and Rebecca. We have to read this part too. 62 to 67. Would somebody read that?
What chapter is that?
That's the same one. That's 24.
This is from the New Revised Standard. Now Isaac had come from Beer Lahal-Rol, and was settled in the Negev. Isaac went out in the evening to walk in the field, and looking up, he saw camels coming. And Rebekah looked up, and when she saw Isaac, she slipped quickly from the camel and said to the servant, "Who is the man over there walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. He took Rebekah, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death.
Then you just finished saying that Abraham was near death. And the next paragraph, right, yeah, says that he got married again and had six more kids. Yeah. He wasn't that close to death.
No, he had a little bit of life in him.
Six more.
So in this section, then, we have the two catching their first glimpse of each other, Isaac looking up. But actually, the focus remains on Rebecca's perception. You know, she also sees him and asks about him, learns it's her husband-to-be, covers herself with a veil, which would be traditional for a bride to be covered. And they waste no time here in consummating their marriage here. It's interesting, he brings her into the tent of his mother, and in the camp here, the women would put up the tents. That was their job, and each woman with her children would have a different tent, so you didn't have one big tent where everybody was living. And he went back, so Isaac went back to his mother's tent, and they started living there, which also places Rebekah as the successor to Sarah, as the of the family. Okay. Well, so this is how Rebekah got involved in this whole story here. And that's part one. Part two, we'll look at the birth of her sons. And as you say, in the next chapter, we have Abraham taking another wife and some other sons of Abraham. But finally, he dies.
I'm going to add a question. I just noticed this. Isaac and Ishmael bury him. And I thought that he was sent away. I thought Ishmael.
Well, it's interesting that in Genesis, you have Isaac and Ishmael as rival sons, and one's sent away, Ishmael's sent away. But at the death of their father, then they're seen back together burying their father. And the same thing in the case of Jacob and Esau. Those are rival sons. They go their separate ways, but then when their father Isaac dies, then both of them appear together burying their father. And then in the case of the 12 sons of Jacob, you know, Joseph is separated, but at the time of their father Jacob's death, they're all together and they all go up and bury him. So it's interesting, there's a series in Genesis, there's a series of rivalries, you know, family tensions, where the family's broken up, but the death of the family always seems to involved coming together of all the parties again in burying the father. So perhaps a moment of reconciliation.
No connection with possession.
No. Completely altruistic. Good point there. Probably, yeah. Well, I try to, you know, work in a theological meaning to it all, but I'm sure there was something much more practical going on here. Good point. All right, so let's look then at what happens here after Abraham dies. So now Abraham and Sarah are both dead, and at least we have a marriage partner for Isaac. But the problem, once again, is the problem of barrenness. Now, okay, you always meet your wife at the well, and your wife is always barren. These are things that just have to happen in these stories. Just patterns that repeat themselves with slight differences. I don't know if some of you are here for last week, we talked about the image of God as mother, and we talked about God's control over human fertility, and this is one of those examples where Rebecca is unable to have children, and it's in response to prayer that she's able to. So would somebody read from, this is chapter 25, verses 19 to 26.
I have Jerusalem.
Thank you.
This is the story of Isaac, son of Abraham.
Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel the Aramean of Paddan Aram, and sister of Laban the Aramean. Isaac prayed to Yahweh on behalf of his wife, for she was barren. Yahweh heard his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. But the children struggled with one another inside her, and she said, "If this is the way of it, will I go on living?" So she went to consult Yahweh, and he said to her, "There are two nations in your womb. Your issue will be two rival peoples. One nation shall have the mastery of the other, and the elder shall serve the younger." When the time came for her confinement, there were indeed twins in her womb. The first to be born was red, and as though he were completely wrapped in a hairy cloak, so they named him Esau. Then his brother was born with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so they named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old at the time of their birth.
Okay, thanks. So here we have Rebekah unable to conceive, and eventually, after a prayer, she does conceive. And then there's this struggle within her womb. You know, a lot of the stories in the Old Testament are stories that have to do with how something came to be the way it is. They're etiological stories. They explain how, in this case, how two nations came into being and what their relationship is to each other. So here, the two children are struggling in the womb, and Rebekah is in pain, and notice that she goes and inquires, asks for an oracle, some kind of answer from God, and has this these words spoken to her. There's no indication that anyone else hears this here. Two nations are in your womb, and the older shall serve the younger. Now this is a reversal, because in the structures of the Hebrew society, the oldest son would receive a double inheritance, so twice he would receive two times what all the other sons would receive. So that was the birthright. And he also received the blessing of the father, where the father would speak to him at the time of his death and confer upon him through words prosperity and a special rank. Seemed that the spoken word during that time was taken a lot more seriously, and this whole idea of being able to speak words and have them somehow have an effect. It's a little different than the way we think of words, but in any event, these two sons were born, and you can tell that this is an etiology, a story about origins, a story about how things have come to be, because of some of the language that's used here. When the first emerges, it's red. Now, the word Edom in Hebrew, and Edom is this region down here. This is the Mediterranean here. This is the Dead Sea here. Edom is this region here to the south and to the east of what came to be Israel and Judah. And this word, literally, Edom, is related to the word red. So it's a kind of a pun. He came out all red. He was an Edomite. And there was this hairy mantle all over him. This whole region here was known as Seir. And in Hebrew, the word Sa'ar, which is related, is hairy. So there's these little puns. So this Edomite, this from Seir, comes out first. He's the firstborn. And then holding his heel is Jacob. Now, the word Jacob, Yaakov, can mean heel. So he's holding the heel. And also, Yaakov means someone, a supplanter, or somebody who takes over somebody else. So his very name here means both heel and also supplanter, or someone who kind of takes advantage of the opportunities and gets ahead. So in their very names here, or in the words that are associated with their names, the character of these two peoples is portrayed. So we see it's an etiology, or a story of origins of these two different nations. And There's some good stories in here, but we don't have a lot of time. So you probably know the story here that Esau was a man who was very comfortable in the outdoors. He was a hunter and kind of a rough guy, big, strong, rough guy. And Jacob was, he liked to stay at home. And the next vision we have here is of Jacob cooking, staying at home cooking while his brother's been out hunting. And Esau is so hungry that he's got to have some of this red lentil porridge. Sounds like something we'd have at the kitchen there. He's got to have some so bad that he sells his birthright, his right to have a double inheritance for this pot of soup. He's a very impulsive. He's depicted as a very impulsive person, whereas Isaac stays at home and cooks and so forth. And it says, we have a little indication here of something that's going to happen, because it says that Rebecca likes Jacob, the one who hangs around at home. And also she's been informed up here of the dramatic switch that's going to happen. Whereas Isaac likes his rough son Esau. Anyway, we should take note that that happens. So Esau gets rid of his birthright by eating soup. Then we're going to skip over a story, which is another example of these type scenes. You know, Abraham and Sarah, they go down to Egypt during a famine, and there's this whole problem of Sarah's beauty, and so Sarah's passed off as Abraham's sister to Pharaoh, and then Pharaoh tries to take Sarah as a wife, and there's also all kinds of problems here, but finally when everything's sorted out, Abraham gets all kinds of wealth, and he leaves the region wealthy. And then this happens again with Abraham and Sarah. They go down to this king of the Philistines, Abimelech in Gerar, and the same kind of thing happens, passes off Sarah as a sister. Abimelech gets in all kinds of trouble here. His wives stop bearing and so forth. And finally, a dream comes to Abimelech, and he says, "What have you done?" And also, at that time, Sarah and Abraham are sent out with riches. And so it happens again here, another example of that kind of use of patterns in the stories. This is an oral culture, and they used sort of patterns in telling their stories. The names are changed, and some of the details are changed. This is another example of that, where in this case Isaac passes Rebekah off as his sister, and Abimelech is interested in her, but Abimelech sees Isaac fondling his sister, playing with his sister. Isaac, the word Isaac means to laugh, and here he's or laugh or play, and here he's playing with his wife. So anyway, the same thing happens here. But we're going to move on here, and we're going to look at the third passage of interest in Rebecca's life. And this is when Isaac's very old. This is where Rebecca's decisive personality really comes into play here, and she calls the shots. Would somebody read chapter 27 down to...
This is for your eyes' standard. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. And prepare for me savory food such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that I may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt the game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring the game and prepare for me savory food that I may eat it, and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flock and fetch me two good kids, that I may prepare from them savory food for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother,
Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him, and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing. His mother said to him, Upon me be your curse, my son. Only obey my word, and go, fetch them to me. So he went, and took them, and brought them to his mother. And his mother prepared savory food, such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in her house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the kids she put upon his hands, and upon the smooth part of his neck. And she gave the savory food and the bread, which he had prepared, into the hand of her son Jacob.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So this is behind the scenes here. Rebekah calling the shots, listening to what's happening, and then changing what goes on. And notice how she orders her son around here, telling him to go and fetch two kids and instructing him to take it to his father. And Jacob objects. He says, you know, he's going to find out. But his mother says, no, you do this. And, you know, if anything bad happens, I'll take it upon myself. So, and she even dresses him up. So very decisive kind of action here. And as we know the story, the deception works. Isaac's a little bit suspicious. The voice isn't quite right, but you know the hair, it's there. And so finally, after eating and drinking, then he blesses his son with all kinds of good things. In verse 28, may God give you the dew of heaven and the fat of earth, abundance of new grain and wine. Let people serve you. Nations bow down to you. Be master over your brothers, and let your mother's son bow to you. Cursed be they who curse you. Blessed be they who bless you. Okay, and then poor Esau comes back later. And there's nothing left. And all he gets is a little, he cries. And then he gets a little saying here in 39. And the translation is very various in this, you'll notice. Yours is probably different than this. See, your abode shall enjoy the fat of the earth and the dew of heaven above. Yet by your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And when you grow restive, you shall break his yoke from your neck. So, and some of yours, it's something like you shall live away from the fat of the land. So it's less of a blessing even than what this implies. So poor Esau, you know, he's really depicted as a very nice guy in these stories. He's a bumbler, you know, he sort of acts out of impulse. But he's portrayed actually very sympathetically. He immediately plots to kill his brother after his father's dead. But later when they come back together, he weeps and he hugs his brother and he forgives him. So you know, he's not depicted as a bad guy. It's like he can't win. Rebecca's influence in the family continues at this point too, because she tells her son, she tells Jacob, get out of here, go back and live with my brother Laban for a while, because your brother is going to kill you. But then she doesn't tell that to Isaac. She says, you know, I don't like Esau's Hittite wives, his foreign wives. Let's send Jacob back home to get a good wife, you know. And so when Isaac talks to his son, he says, yeah, you better go on up and get a good wife. It's like Isaac's not quite there. He's not, the real person behind all this is Rebekah. So we have a few minutes remaining, and I just wanted to hear some reactions to the story from you people, but I want to just point out a few things that I think of when I read these stories. And one is that women such as Rebekah, and actually not just women, but Moses and so forth, they somehow act against the structures that are in place. You know, she gets the younger son to get the blessing here. And it seems kind of devious, but in the Hebrew Bible, it's not always the structures of society, the laws and so forth, the human ordering of things that is the conduit of the divine purpose. And here we have an example of an unexpected turn of events. And as as a woman with little direct power. She uses unconventional means too. I guess when I read this, the larger question that comes to mind, you know, we can say that Rebecca is the one who's bringing about God's will that's expressed in the oracle through unexpected means. But larger question about this whole idea of blessing, you know, one brother getting blessing, the other without any blessing. It's always been problematic to me also. And he is depicted as a very nice guy. But then these are the folk stories of a particular people, and it's the people that's the the descendants of Jacob and not Esau. Mm-hmm.
Why is it problematic that a family should want to establish and keep the family home? I mean, is it we're faced with some of these questions, five children in my family, my father dies, we sort of like to keep the family home together. Mm-hmm. If we split it up evenly, it'll have to be sold. Mm-hmm. You can't sell five parts of a building. Mm-hmm. Isn't there some advantage to a family in saying that this will descend to the oldest, and then it will also be used by the rest of the family, but always to the oldest? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it you think simply that the land ought to be divided equally among the children, so if we get farms of 100 feet by 100 feet eventually, that's better than having one large farm of a 200 or 300
feet? No, you raise a very good point. It's for practical reasons, mm-hmm, that these provisions for the oldest son were set up. But it's interesting to me that time and time again in the Hebrew Scriptures, you know, that's the law, but the favored son is often the youngest. You have in the case of Jacob and Esau, in the case of Isaac and Ishmael, in the case of David, he's the youngest son, in the case of Joseph, mm-hmm, the youngest among his brothers. So, you're very right. Our human society creates rules and ways of working that are very practical, and you're absolutely right. But the amazing thing in the Hebrew Bible is the number of times that this is twisted around, and it's God doesn't always work through our human ordering of society.
Well, it's also true in fairy tales, and I think it's, mm-hmm, because of the enormous pressure that comes about by the people who are not the oldest son. Mm-hmm. You know, that I'm an oldest son, and I think this is a great idea.
Oh, yeah.
But the percentage of people who are not oldest sons is very high. Mm-hmm. They resent that. Mm-hmm.
True.
But you don't want the family farm, so I mean...
What I find interesting is that she knew about this at birth, that, mm-hmm, she was told that there was twins and one under the order of things. She knew about it all along, mm-hmm, yet she never told her husband. Mm. It seems as though if she told her husband, and this is the way it was to be, that if this was from God, that the husband would have had to been fooled in the end. And Esau would have known this and would have accepted it because that was from God. But that's not.
So he might have just said, "Look, you always liked Jacob better.
You made it up."
Yeah.
Well, it's just hard for me to. Mm-hmm. To
we wouldn't have a good story.
You said you're also. Is this the only exception to your rule that the women never get a direct oracle from God?
Oh no! I mean, Hagar, for example, is a. And this is an example of where God speaks directly to her. But you notice that when Rebecca does this whole deception, she doesn't have any divine instructions to do that. She's a...
Well, but it was laid out earlier in the story, so you know, mm-hmm, that she's following the will of God. She's obedient to God's expressed will when she does this.
Mm-hmm. But maybe God was going to act later on or whatever, but she took the initiative.
Yeah.
Well, it strikes me that they're not interested in theological ideas, mm-hmm, or the soul or salvation. They're interested in Rebecca's very practical, earthy, mm-hmm, things that she's involved in. And seemingly this is what God is interested in, mm-hmm, too. So it's a different way of thinking about the world and who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really tribal legends
that
we're dealing with here.
Uh-huh. The pondering is a path, too.
I'm sorry.
For women, pondering, hearing what the Lord has to say, and keeping it in their heart and thinking about it and watching it acted out or taking initiative, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's a family for a lot of the women.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So, I remember hearing something about Mary and that pondering. Mm-hmm. they don't come out and say. It's something very typical in the Bible not to come out and
different
say.
Different way of
exercising power. Like right. They would tell everybody about it.
Yeah.
See, that goes against that stereotype of women who can't blabbing all the time.
Any other,
those days there's a lot of intermarriage, wasn't there, on the families?
Intermarriage, you mean marriage within the family?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very common in these tribal
today,
societies.
They really discourage that.
Mm-hmm. Although if you go over to this region of the world here, you'll find that marriage between cousins is very common. In fact, I know a family that lives on in East Jerusalem. It's a Palestinian family, and actually their family is from Hebron, which is the same region here. And they have a number of cousins, first cousins that have married. And actually the family has a large number of birth defects, or not birth defects, they're more, it's, I guess they are, but weak eyesight and you know, the club feet, they're really common in the family. But the woman who's married to her cousin told me, she said, you know, it's very good for relations between the family. It's not so good for the health of the children, but it's very good for the relations between the family because, you know, the two sides of the in-laws aren't strangers. I guess it keeps the wealth in the family, too. Yeah. Any other closing comments here? We're out of time, but I did want to...
Is there a well around here? Is my question.
But it doesn't work right now. You'll have to wait.
It hasn't worked for me for years.
Okay. maybe the way trial would give you some water. Anyway, if you have any advice for this young man who'd like to recreate this scene, speak to him after the session.
Do you want to be Moses or do you want to be...
At this point, it doesn't matter.
All right, thanks a lot. Tomorrow we'll look at another one of the women in the Bible.